Hi, this is Paul, and part of having my own channel sometimes means getting to do what I want to do, and this is something that I have wanted to do for a very long time. Now, Rod Hugin has shown up on one of my pre-synod little things I did in my denominational work once, so some of you might recognize his face, but Rod is one of the people that If I needed to have a pastor, I would want Rod to be my pastor, because he has been a pastor to me. Rod and I met when we were both serving on a board together, and we were both flying in from the West Coast, so we'd both not be able to sleep at night because of the jet lag, and so we'd hang out together. Rod pastors a little church called The Village in Tucson, Arizona, and again, if I lived in Tucson and I was looking for a church, there's frankly only one church I would think about, and that would be Rod's church, because that is very much how much I think about him and how deeply I respect him. But don't tell him that, because it'll just make him big, and he's already too big. So
yeah, my head is pretty large as it is.
So the reason I got Rod on is he wants me to write a little blurb for a book that he's doing. And I said I would only do that in exchange for a conversation with him online. So I'm paying in advance of the thing that I'm supposed to do. So Rod, I am so pleased you're here today. And I don't see Rod and I have talked so much over the years, it's kind of hard to know where to begin. But one of the things I wanted Rod to do was read something that he wrote on a little forum called CRC Voices that I participate in. And Rod often posts things like this on Voices. A number of years ago, I applied to be editor of The Banner, which is our denominational publication, and I didn't even get an interview, which probably shows the wisdom of the denomination. But but I promised Rod, I said, Rod, if I ever become editor of The Banner, you will have a weekly column, which is difficult because the thing comes out monthly. But I don't know anybody who communicates faith in writing better than Rod in the way that he does it, because he does it through his life and the people around him. So I've just raised expectations terribly high, Rodney. So now we're about to disappoint.
Yeah, this is the funniest guy I've ever met. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, I always hate those kind of intros. That's great. This drivel that I write, and then you're going to turn it into something. So, yeah.
It is not drivel, my friend. It is not drivel. Well, do you have anything to say before we jump into your story about your mother's best friend?
Yeah, I just thank you for what you say. I love to write. Writing is escape for me, and it's a place where I can. I had a instructor in high school, my high school English teacher, who later became a wonderful mentor for me in writing. He said, write fiction, because then you can write the truth. And if you write nonfiction, you're writing lies. And being the obstinate one that I am, and being the contrarian that I am, I said, no, I want to tell real stories and tell the truth. So I've been trying to do that. I don't always succeed, but I love words. I grew up loving words. My dad discouraged me from being a writer, because he said you couldn't make a living at it. And so which he's right. Unless you're going to send me some money, I don't know. I just love words. I love to play with words. I love poetry. I love writing in general. So, and then in dealing with my issues and dealing with my own struggles in life, writing becomes the place where I can tell the truth. And so, yeah.
Well, part of the reason, Rod, I really want to whatever degree I can promote your fame, I want to do so, because you need to read your own audiobooks, because you not only are an amazing writer, you've got a great voice for it. So
and a great face for radio as well.
And if you ever meet Rod, see, the first impression, people who watch my channel, then they meet me in person, they always look at me and they say, oh, you're taller than you are on YouTube. Well, you know what? Rod's a lot taller than he is on YouTube. Yeah, yes. If you think I'm big, you've never met Rodney. Yes.
The 6'8", and it's the 325 pounds that goes with it. That's the problem. But,
Well, Rod, why don't we begin with what you wrote on Voices, and we'll just take the conversation where it goes after that.
All right. Yeah, I just wrote this. I'll read it. Ruth died. She was my mother's best friend and the wife of Pete, who became something like a dad to us kids after our dad died back in 1969. Pete would come over most weekends and do things like fix a leaking faucet or replace a water pump on Mom's 88 Oldsmobile or help Mom with balancing the bank book. It was the stuff of everyday life. Ruth would most often come with him, and she and Mom would chat while Mom ironed clothes or mopped the kitchen floor or fixed bologna sandwiches for lunch. Ruth would pitch in as needed. I remember them sitting on the couch in the living room with Ruth knitting baby clothes for the latest baby at church while Mom was asking for a 7-letter word for whatever clue had stymied her in her latest crossword puzzle. They would chatter away about the recent news from Pella, Iowa, where they had both lived before moving to Phoenix, or how to get grass stains out of a kid's dress pants, or some convoluted story of the antics of one of the dozens of stray cats that Ruth took in throughout the years, or any of a myriad of mundane day-to-day topics that crossed their minds. They were also the kind of friends I could just sit in silence for long periods of time. Occasionally they'd get into a snit with each other, and somehow they'd always work it out. They loved each other. She and Mom were best friends. A childless woman and a young widow with four orphaned kids found a deep bond and a million things to hold in common. Pete and Dad had been best friends back in Pella as well. They were in the same class at school, Mom and Dad, Pete and Ruth, good friends all around. When Pete died back in 2003, I had agreed to conduct the funeral. It was a very difficult thing to do. I struggled with what to say, and the emotions were completely raw and ever at the surface, and they kept choking me up. Having to minister to others when I just longed to be ministered to was rough. And I decided then and there that I wouldn't do a funeral like that ever again. But when Ruth called a few months ago and asked if I would conduct her funeral when the time came, I agreed to do it. How could I say no? I couldn't say no. Ruth died last week on Tuesday, and her brothers and sister planned the funeral for Monday. They flew in from the Midwest, and we arranged things over the phone and through emails. I drove to Phoenix on Saturday evening to pick up my sister and brother at the airport. We all slept at my son Justin's house. We reminisced late into the night. On Sunday, we spent more time talking, remembering, laughing, crying, and telling Pete and Ruth stories. I worked on my funeral sermon in little scraps of time that I found throughout the day. The message I wrote was taken from 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 9 through 12. Where we're asked to make it our ambition to lead a quiet life, to love well, to work with our hands, to not have to be dependent on others. The verse talks about the simple, peaceful, quiet life that was so exemplified in Ruth. Of course, I also wanted to include a few comments from James 1, verse 27, where James reminds us that true religion is taking care of widows and orphans. Ruth did that, and so did Pete. No big splashy program put on by some megachurch to help widows and orphans adjust to their new realities. Just simple, quiet, behind-the-scenes acts of love and kindness throughout the long, hard days after our dad died. Ruth was a practitioner of true religion. Pete as well. I asked my sister Miriam if she knew why Pete and Ruth had moved to Phoenix just a few short months after our family had moved from Pella back in December of 1960. Miriam looked at me in shock and said, "You don't know that story?" Well, obviously I didn't. So she told me what Mom had told her. Our dad was very, very sick with emphysema back in 1960, and it was a rough winter in Iowa. The doctors had warned him to move to a warm, dry climate or he would soon be dead. They doubted he would survive the winter. So with the help of neighbors and friends, he packed everything up and moved us to Arizona. Dad and Mom's best friends, Pete and Ruth, helped send them off. It was a sad day leaving the family and leaving friends. Lots of tears were shed. A few months later, Pete sold his Hudson car dealership and Russ's auto service and sales, and he and Ruth packed up their earthly possessions and also moved to Phoenix. Ruth told our mom that Pete had wanted them to move as soon as possible so that they could be near our family and help in case something happened to Dad. Pete wanted to be near us in case his best friend, Ray, died. Pete and Ruth gave up their lives in Pella to be able to help their friends in Phoenix. It's a crazy story. I don't know why I had never heard it before. My siblings all knew it. I didn't. Who does that? Who lays down their life and livelihood for their friend? But that is exactly what they did. And help they did. A million tiny acts of kindness and generosity throughout all those years. A million simple offerings of love. Day after day after day, faithfulness. They took care of a widow and her orphaned children. At the end of my message, I couldn't read James 1:27. I tried. I gritted my teeth and willed myself to do it. I started, but it was impossible to see the words through my tears. I started and stopped and started again. Religion that God accepts as pure and faultless is this. But I couldn't finish. I couldn't stop sobbing. And after a long, long time, I could finally choke out the words. To look after widows and orphans in their distress. And that's what Pete and Ruth did. What amazing people they were. That's it.
You know, it just, you know, I read that and I just thought the truth, you know, in we have this, Christianity has this crisis where it watches people walk away from the faith and our answer is better apologetics and smarter people and better arguments. But what Pete and Ruth did for your mother and father and for you and your siblings, that is so often the most powerful witness to the gospel that we have. And I would say anyone can do it, but that's not true.
Right. They had no children of their own. They were why they would do that, that act of love, and with that intentionality, right? I find myself sometimes getting irritated because I have to bring somebody a meal because, you know, they had a baby or there was a death in the family or something. And then you go, oh, I guess I got to bring some food. Like they, one little act of kindness is sometimes hard. And then to realize they did that over and over and over again. And, you know, they were as much a part of our life. Like we don't, at the graveyard, Mom and Dad are buried next to each other. And when Dad died, Pete and Ruth bought plots at the cemetery for Dad and Mom, and then bought the two next to them for themselves. So all four of them are together in at the graveyard. So That's a special kind of love. So no, I don't think everybody can do it. think everybody could strive to do it, and I think people could, I don't know, the love of God in them is phenomenal. And and to see that play out so sacrificially. I think I often look at, I have a church full of young people, and I think, what do you sacrifice? What do you submit to? What do you lay down? What do you give up? And I know when I was in that stage of life, it was, what can I acquire? What can I get? How can I succeed? But God's kingdom is an upside down kingdom. And in that upside down kingdom, none of that stuff matters. And what Pete and Ruth did, you know, I just imagine, you know, I mean, Billy Graham's, I'm sure, in heaven, but he's sitting out there in the crowd somewhere. And I think Ruth is probably sitting up there next to Jesus and at the banquet, right? I mean, I really do think that. Like, you know, we think of the fame and we think of the, and I'm not saying anything bad about Billy. I admired his life, but I just see that kind of small, and yeah, were they sin free? And no, they were. They had their ugly sides too, and they had their difficulties, and you know, some of those those are as real too. And so I don't want to paint them as these perfect saints who never screwed up, but their life was a life of goodness and kindness. And my little sister has cerebral palsy, and she sustained horrific operations when she was little, and so she would be in a cast from waist to toe, both legs, for an entire summer. And after they went in and clipped muscles and did all kinds of surgeries on her, so we always had my sister Ruth, so we'd say, you know, Sister Ruth or the other Ruth, and when we talked about them, and my sister Ruth, you know, was 5 years old, and yeah, people would come and they'd bring toys for her to play with and stuffed animals and things like that, but Pete and Ruth knew how much she loved kitties, and so Ruth brought over some kittens that they had gotten. She was like the original cat lady. She always had cats that they had rescued, and she would bring the kittens over and let Ruth play with them and pet them, and just thinking like that. It wasn't, she would write me notes when I moved down here, and she'd always include clippings from a newspaper or some article that she had read, and later on with emails, and she'd send some link to something that she thought I would enjoy reading or would know about. So everything was individualized. There was no, she wouldn't send out a Christmas newsletter. She would send out 50 letters, each individually written for the person, for the recipient. It's crazy. She was, matter of fact, we went to her house after the funeral on Monday, and in the one closet, there's just boxes and boxes of envelopes and thank you cards and note cards blank with envelopes so that she could continue to send them out. And even with the advent of email and everything else, and she would still send personal cards, which always light and breezy and full of information and newsy stuff. And, you know, and I don't know, encouraging when things were really hard, planting the church and starting the church, you know, they would all of a sudden there'd come this little note and, hey, just was thinking of you today and wondering how you're doing, how's the church going, and you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, pretty amazing.
I love that you included that, you know, when her and your mother would say, get in a little snit, that, you know,
right.
Because that's so important for people to know, because people don't understand that they're just people. I mean,
right.
We say stupid things. We get sideways from each other. We offend each other. We have soft spots in us.
Right. And they would go a couple weeks without talking, you know, like, oh, you know, I'm mad at Ruth. Well, what did she do? She said this, or, you know, she said this about me, or I think she, you know, or, you know, Ruth would be, I'm not happy with your mother. Oh, well, what did she do? Well, she offended me by whatever. But they couldn't maintain it, right? You can't maintain a snit. It's just not possible. And when you think about it, they didn't have, I mean, other than Pella, Iowa growing up, they didn't have a lot in common. I mean, how does someone who's got four orphan kids and a woman who's never, and they weren't, I think they were, what, 7 years apart in age. So it wasn't like they had exact age and stage stuff either. Like, it was, they didn't have a lot in common. Oh, we used to laugh that they had eating disorders in common. my mom was so skinny and tiny, and so was Ruth. And Ruth was just this health food nut. And I mean, and before it was fashionable. And so she was always, I got in a whole thing with her about honey. She was telling me the benefits of honey, and all the honey was the greatest thing in the world. And I said, well, it's still a sugar, right? Yeah, I said, because she wouldn't eat sweets. And I said, well, I think you're eating sweets if you're eating honey. And she said, no. And she'd argue with me. And finally, you know, and I said, well, yeah, I get processed sugar. It's better than processed sugar. I'm fine with that. But it's still sugar. And she was like, no. So she would send me newspaper clippings and links to things. And finally, I said, okay, Ruth, you win. Honey's great. You know, and then it's like she kept, like, for years. As a matter of fact, probably 2 years ago, she still sent me something about the benefits of raw honey. And okay, you win. You know, you couldn't. So, yeah, she wasn't, like I said, she was quirky as all get out. I mean, those are the fun things about her as well. Like, at the memorial service, people were telling those crazy, quirky side of her. And I love that. Like, that's who she was. But yeah, she'd get angry the whole food thing, my friend Marv used to go over and visit them. First my mom, and then he says, your mother would complain about Ruth not eating and that she had an eating disorder and she was anorexic and she should put on some weight and she wasn't doing well. And he says, then I go over and I visit Ruth, and Ruth would say, yeah, Bernice is just in bad shape, and she doesn't eat, and she is so skinny, and that dress just hangs on her. She needs to put on. And he says, so I got them together one day. I said, you guys take each other out for a steak, for crying out loud, you know? But there was no way. So it was just those are fun things.
Well, and what what I love about your writing, Rod, is exactly that. You, just like you said earlier, did you say that before we started recording or not? I don't know. I think it was after we started recording about the telling the truth. And yeah, you said that after we started recording, but because, and even though Wayne Ribbons, who we will name, says that, says something about the stories you tell.
Contain a kernel of truth.
Okay. but it is, And you and I, part of what we both enjoy together is we both pastor churches that, it's so funny when people complain I don't finish my sentences. Can you believe that? Yeah. Or my thoughts. But Pete, we both pastor churches that are full of authenticity, but not the kind of authenticity people say they want. Well, I want it to be authentic, like what, like Instagram? No, I want, you know, right. You want to see authenticity? You know, go to the Village and you'll see authenticity. Yes. And probably someone in Tucson will watch this and think, oh, I got to go visit that Village. They're going to walk through the door. They're probably going to be horrified by what they find.
Right. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. To address the kernel of truth thing, Mr. Kelly, my English teacher, also said the truth is not always in the facts, right? and so I hang on to that. But these are really true. The other thing that I've learned is it is perception, right? We can all be sitting in the same room and we see things very differently. And we hear things very differently. And one of the things, like hearing nuance of words and how people say things and all that, and so much of that gets lost in writing. And so it's hard to capture some of that stuff. But I do laugh about, because Wayne will say, you know, I was in the same room and it didn't happen that way. But then I think, yeah, because you weren't listening for the same things I was listening for. And then we also often get hooked, right? I get hooked by, even this story, like all of a sudden I realize, wow, I missed out. My siblings knew this, that Pete and Ruth had moved there. And I think if I had known that 20 years ago or 15 years ago or whenever they found it out, I don't know, would I have done something different? Would I have thought differently about them? Pete and I worked together. He was one of my first bosses. So I worked at an auto parts warehouse and he got me the job. Matter of fact, right after Dad died, he said, you have to go get a job because
you're the man of the family now.
I was. And so I was 16 when Dad died. So shortly after the funeral, matter of fact, I wasn't yet 16. Is that right? But anyway, I went and he said, you know, you're going to have to apply for the job. Well, I never applied for a job and I didn't know what that was going to look like. And I was terrified. And so he said, well, you know, so I put on a tie and put on a good shirt and, you know, and went, and I had to meet Dow Batson, the boss, and I just remember going in there trembling and scared because I didn't know anything about auto parts, and this was an auto parts warehouse, and I didn't know what I was doing, and I was, you know, and Dow said, oh, you're the guy that Pete's talking about, and I said, yeah, and he said, okay, you're hired. That was my interview.
clearly an unjust hire.
Right, yeah.
There was bias and preference all over that hire.
Exactly. And so, but then Pete and I worked together, and then I went back to school and left there and went back to school, and then afterwards went back, and then by that time he was president and general manager, or he became president and general manager, and I was chief financial officer of the company. So it was definitely, and then we had our falling out a falling out over the business stuff. I was an elder in the church. We were deacons together. Matter of fact, somebody at the funeral was just saying, you guys used to count the money at church like nobody's business. It was so incredibly fast. And we were all just like, wow, we don't even know what they're doing. So it's an awkward thing to not have a father, but have somebody who plays a lot of that role, but not, you can't play all the roles. And I think that was, it was hard for me. It was hard to lose Dad at that age. And it was hard to, see Pete in that role. I would never have thought to call him Dad, or would have even, and certainly not Ruth. We were talking how Pete was always in the background, like he was always quietly helping. And Ruth was even quieter and further in the background. Like there was no bigness about them. There was no, I don't know. I have a big, huge voice and I have a big, huge presence, and so do you. And so I can walk in a room and take it over and dominate, and you know, that was not them. They couldn't have done it if they wanted to. But just those quiet servants, make it your ambition. When I talked about that at the funeral, like make it your ambition to lead a quiet life. When I think of ambition, I think of everything but a quiet life. That phrase has always stuck out to me in scripture. Like because I think of ambition. I think, man, getting ahead and doing it right and amassing a fortune and getting the right girl and getting her to marry me or whatever. Like, I'm going to succeed. Life is going to work out really well until it doesn't, and then I'm going to regroup and succeed. We're so into that. And so ambition, I think, is that, I don't know, it's a big deal. And to see somebody like Pete who, made it his ambition, to see somebody like Ruth who made it her ambition to just be behind the scenes and not be noticed and not care. And it doesn't mean, I mean, like, I have a million stories of the ways in which, like, we did do things. Pete wanted us, I think he wanted us boys to have, you know, fishing trips and all those things, but he wasn't a fisherman. But I know they built the Glen Canyon Lake, Glen Canyon Dam up in Page. And so Pete also, like, he never swore. He never, you know, you never heard him say a bad word ever, like, not once. He'd say, shoot, you know, that was about as close to a when he got frustrated. But I remember we were working at Charlie Jones Battery and Electric Company in Phoenix. And he said, we'd been working on Mom's car week after week, and we finally got it all going. He says, now that we got it working good, why don't we go up to Page and we can see what's going on at this lake. And so he's telling the guys at work, yeah, this Saturday we're going to drive up to Page and we're going to take the dam tour. And and Pete and everybody's shocked that he would say the word damn, you know, and that he's actually embarrassed. So that was like the coolest thing. Like, you're going to take the damn tour. But it was just so silly. And then he couldn't figure out what, there was a squeak coming from the back of Mom's car. And so we're driving it around. I got my driver's license. So I'm driving the car and he's listening he's got the window open. And it only happened when we would turn right, make right turns. So we're just going around the block making right turns. And there's this lady, she's out watering her lawn, and she watches us go by several times. And then the first time, you know, we're all sitting in the car. Second time, we're all sitting in the car. Third time, Pete's got the back window open, and he's kind of leaning out the window. And he says, I think it's coming from the back wheel or somewhere by the trunk. And so he's leaning out the window to try to listen. Then we stop. He tells me to stop the car. He gets out, gets in the trunk, pulls the lid of the trunk down, and he says, okay, drive. And then we drive around, and we're at the corner where this lady's out watering, and he lifts the trunk lid up, and he leans out, and he's listening as far out as he can, listening at the wheel. For what's happening. And guys, that lady drops the hose and goes into the water running out on the street. I'm sure she called the cops. I never wondered about the crazy neighbors. It was that kind of stuff. They were fun and, you know, quiet senses, and they'd laugh at themselves. And I mean, they, you know, when I tell that story, they would just roar because that was, and, you know, quiet, wonderful, yeah. Beautiful people. Yeah. Just, yeah. Scarily, wonderfully beautiful.
And the world, you know, I don't quite want to say the world is full of them, but I don't, probably shouldn't say the world is lousy with them, but it's, I mean, that we meet these people, we know these people, they are, you know, that they are the saints among us. But you're so right. We don't even notice them. We don't value them. And perhaps that's part of God's economy to say that, well, it's Christ, right? I mean, it's the beginning of the Gospel of John. The world, they didn't know him. It's too busy with the darkness to bother with the light.
Right. The other thing that I noticed about them, matter of fact, he taught me this. He taught me a lot about investing and doing all kinds of things. But he said, early on, he said, I want to teach you how to give so that people don't know you're giving. So he said, did you know you can call the gas company, if somebody's gas gets turned off, you can call them and you can just pay the bill. And they'll never know who paid the bill, or the electric company or whatever. They'll never know. He said, and the great thing about that is then you have to give glory to God. They can't, you don't get any credit for it, but God does. So people get all excited. So he would do that. Like he would just, and he would go to, like we went to Christian grade school, and he, later on, I became the bookkeeper, or one of the, I mean, it was part of my, one of my jobs when I went to business for myself, was to keep the books for this little school. And he would just come in and say, here's the check for X number of dollars, and I want you to apply it to the oldest balance on somebody that you're about to dismiss from the school. Just give it, just put it on their account. But it's anonymous. You're not allowed to say who it's from. I just blew that, but he's not around to complain. So, but that kind of thing of giving, targeted giving to solve people's problems. And, you know, after Dad died, we went to Christian schools. The tuitions were steep. We would say, my mom said, you know, I can remember saying, well, you guys aren't going to have to go to the public school because, and, you know, leave your friends because we can't afford this. And then we get a call from the school, hey, someone's paid your tuition for the year for the kids. So they're in. And that went all the way through high school. And my sister went away to college, and she was saying, she said, you know, she had gotten scholarships and all the things you get. She was the smart one in our family. But there was still this $400 balance or something left on her account at the end of the semester, and they were, or after everything was paid, and they, you know, there was a deadline for her to pay that. And so she had mentioned to Mom, she said, I don't know where I'm going to get that. I guess I'll have to work, you know, she was working part-time anyway, but she said, I'll have to see if I can work out some sort of arrangement with them. And, you know, that she went in, that she got a notice from the, please come to the finance department. And those are always terrifying letters. And they said, your account's paid in full. And by the way, next semester as well. So that kind of thing, you know, I know it was them. I, you know, I can't imagine it wasn't them, you know, but that, because you don't know, like you really don't know. And so you do say, thank you, God. Cause, yeah. Pete used to, when I started the church, every single month, Pete would get in his car, drive 125 miles to Tucson from Phoenix, buy my lunch, turn around, drive 125 miles back, just to encourage me. And he said, I'm so glad we had all that kerfuffle at the at Charlie Jones at the end, and I chose the other guy to be the chief financial, or to be the Knicks president. And he says, I know it got us into a struggle, and I know I hurt you and you hurt me and that on all that. But he said, I'm so glad I did it, because if I hadn't, you would have never started this church. You would have never left, and God would have never used you the way he's using you now. And that always struck me. But every single month, you know, here you come, and I'm buying your lunch. And then later on, towards the end, when he couldn't drive, he got somebody else to drive him down. And just a few months before he died, he had emphysema as well as my dad. So that was hard to watch.
You know, I'm struck by, you know, in the Gospel of John, where there's, you know, one of my favorite stories in the Gospel of John is the man born blind, because I just love the way he deals with the religious leaders there,
right.
and the way his parents deal with them. But you know, the disciples ask Jesus, who sinned, he or his parents? And Jesus gives this answer, which is completely offensive. Well, this is just so, you know, God could be glorified. And you say, how does someone being born blind glorify God? And your story is just dripping with this, because, you know, one thing, you know, God blessed you with lots of stories, and all of those stories are, you know, are tragedy. You know, your father dies and your family uproots, and these crazy people go to take care of, you know, your poor mother and her four children, one of whom has a very significant illness, and you who's got your own issues.
You noticed, yes.
Yes. Well, I mean, I've read your Born Blurry, which is something we'll have to talk about at some point too, not today, but another day. But, you know, all of this tragedy in your life, I mean, and your life continues to have tragedy. And I know that. And, you know, your son was in the hospital not that long ago and wondering if he'd make it. And you're in a church full of tragedy, and there's never enough money. I know that. And I know the ridiculous sums of money that you get paid for that church. I get supported much better by my church than you've ever been supported by your church. And you know, back in the days when this is some CRC inside baseball, when, you know, they're handing out Article 7s all over the place, and some people decided, no more Article 7. So that Rodney's a evangelist, and then commission pastor, and I mean, all of these things. I mean, Rod, you just, if someone looked at your life, they'd say, boy, this guy, you know, this guy didn't just get one losing lottery ticket. He got one after another. But out of all of this, you see this glory that God has made. And it's not in any way the kind of stuff that this world is ambitious to collect.
But you don't know God's grace until you desperately need it, right? I was born pretty blind, almost legally blind. So, and they didn't know, so they just thought I was not bright, which there's also that. And I was, you know, so I was in, they were going to put me in a special school, but then they decided to send me to a doctor first, and they discover I'm blind as a bat. And so, and I love the story of the blind man too, but for different reasons. It's like, do you think that's a joy? Like, that is not, you, all of a sudden you can see, you're processing information you have never processed in your life. Like, my brain blew up. I had massive headaches. It was so hard to use glasses. Those first months, years, I would rip my glasses off my face, and I still do. I often take them when I get nervous or scared. Like, you go to that calm place where everything's blurry, and then you find out you're severely ADD, and so you can't focus on anything in the classroom, and so they're having the conversations with you about, he doesn't pay attention. He doesn't do his work. He's staring off into the, you know, out the window. He's riding the tractor with his dad when he's supposed to be doing math, you know? And so, and I didn't realize, I recently, to deal with my sleep disorder, which I also have, I don't sleep well at all. And so I went to see this specialist. She's a psychiatrist, psychologist, and she's a special, her specialty is sleep disorder. I just saw her last week, so it was interesting to talk with her. And then, you know, tell me your story. And so you start telling the story, and she's asking all these questions, and, you know, I tell her about dad dying and some of these other things. And she says, wow, you had significant trauma in your life, and really significant trauma. And I kind of bristled. She says, why are you upset about that? And I said, because I've seen trauma, and I am a blessed man. Are you kidding me? I've seen real trauma. I've seen people that are abused and beaten and mistreated. I've seen people that are, you know, were shot at and stabbed. And like, when I think of trauma, I think of a whole, like, what I went through is nothing compared to what they went through. And then she said, that's not true. You know, that trauma is trauma. But then I realized I had Pete and Ruth, and I had family, and, you know, I had God's love. God sustains you through all those things. And that's why, like, there are times when I get frustrated There are times when I start to doubt God's goodness, and then I go back and go, look at your stupid life. Like, look at how God's maintained you and held you and cared for you and sent angels, sent loving, kind, godly people to, I lost my dad, but I had other people who stepped into those roles in amazing ways. And you know, now I'm at the village, I got all these young people, and then like they want dad advice from me, and I'm going, what the heck are you asking me for dad advice? Like, I have no clue. But the truth is, I do have a clue, and it's because I got a much broader experience of what's required and of a dad and a good dad, and Pete is a part of that, and others as well. My high school English teacher, all these people who walked with me and cared about me and thought about me. And I'm a blessed man. Like I cannot believe how good I have it, and because of the grace of God.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to,
in the midst of a lot of trouble.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to wrap this up here. And cause I think this was good. Now, have you posted this piece on a blog or anything, or
it's on our village church website, villagersonline .com. So I did just post it there. So
I can put a link to it in the notes in
case you could
read it and refer other people to it. And
sure.
So Rod, I very much want to do this again.
Okay.
I hope that you're willing. I know you've got a lot. I do also make it my ambition to make you famous. So,
and meanwhile, I'm making it my ambition to lead a quiet life.
That's right. I'm going to bring yet more trauma to your life, Rodney. That's
great.
Just what I'm going to do.
So, you're such a great friend. Thanks.
Well, I am going to stop the recording, and just so don't hang up. So
thanks, Paul.
Again, thank you, Rod.